Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau. He was an Italian immigrant who became an American idol, whose very name conjured up visions of romance and exoticism. His name was Rudolph Valentino, and he'll be the subject of our interview this week with Emily Leiter, the author of Dark Lover, The Life and Death of Rudolph Valentino. After that, Fiona Beatty will tell us about a website where we can learn more about Valentino. And to conclude the show, for our guest commentary of the week, Edwin Black will offer us his thoughts on the origins of the conflict in the Middle East. But first, let's look at a few items of historical interest in the news. First, an update on an item we reported on earlier. An investigation of artifacts that were purported to be the work of ancient Israelites has led to the indictments of five alleged members of an antiquities forgery ring in Israel, including a doctoral student at the University of Haifa. The Israel Antiquities Authority established a committee of experts to examine the objects, an ossuary or funeral box for human bones with the inscription James, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus, a stone tablet, and pottery fragments with inscriptions dating from the era of Solomon's temple. The objects were not found in situ, meaning they were not found in archaeological excavations, but rather on the antiquities market with no record of their discovery or past ownership. Some archaeologists and paleographic experts certified the authenticity of the objects and their inscriptions, but others were skeptical, leading to the investigation. The committee of experts concluded that most of the objects did indeed date to the Israelite period, but that the inscriptions they bore had been added recently by forgers seeking to increase the value of the finds by linking them to the temple period. Edward Greenstein, a professor of biblical studies at Tel Aviv University and a specialist in ancient Semitic texts, believes that little historical work will be affected by the revelation of forgery. It removes some of the pieces of evidence that have been used by scholars and others who want to believe in the historical authenticity of various events or phenomena described in the Bible, like Solomon's temple itself. There may in fact not be any direct evidence, but a good historian won't doubt the existence of the temple because of that. I always tell my students that if you see the footprints of the fox, you don't have to see the fox itself. And apropos our interview this week, a copy of Rudolph Valentino's silent film, Beyond the Rocks, has been found in the Netherlands. It's the only known existing print of the 1922 classic. The film was found in the estate of a film collector from the city of Haarlem. The collection came into the possession of the Amsterdam Film Museum 4 years ago. Next up, more on Rudolph Valentino with author Emily Leiter. You're listening to Talking History. Rudolph Valentino was one of America's earliest matinee idols. On the screen, he was dark, exotic, magnetic, virile, animal-like, even savage, and the woman loved him. But what was he really like? How did he cultivate his image? And how did that image affect his personal life? Talking History's Eileen Dugan explores these and other questions concerning Valentino with the author of a new book on the actor, Emily Leiter. Leiter talked to Eileen Dugan by phone from her office.
Turn on any entertainment news program, and you'll see it. The red carpet, the photographers, the male matinee idol, and the hordes of screaming girls. The scene is commonplace today, and we tend to dismiss such pandemonium as typical teeny bopper behavior. Long before there was a Brad or Tom or Leo, another actor made women, older, married women, swoon. Rudolph Valentino. Women adored him. Men couldn't understand why. Watching the Sheik on late-night TV, we too may wonder at the cult of personality that sprang up around Valentino. What was it about this actor that made him such a sensation in life and in death? With us today to examine the phenomenon that was Valentino is Emily W. Leiter, author of Dark Lover, The Life and Death of Rudolph Valentino. Welcome, Ms. Leiter.
Thank you for having me.
What do we know about Valentino's youth? Did he always want to be an actor? Where did he come from?
Valentino came from southern Italy, from Apulia. He was born in a town called Castellaneta, not far from Taranto. I don't know at what point he started thinking about being a performer. He certainly was always a very flamboyant young man and child, never a good student. His parents were very respectable people. His father was a veterinarian, and his mother was educated too, and prior to her marriage, she was a companion to a noblewoman, which is a very distinguished kind of occupation. And I don't think that his parents would have been very hospitable to a son who said he wanted to be an actor. Actors were never very respectable. He trained to be a landscape gardener, but having completed his course of study, he didn't get a job in Italy, and at that point, he decided to try his luck in New York.
How did he initially earn his living in New York?
He was fired. His one job as a gardener didn't work out after he absconded with a motorcycle that belonged to another employee and crashed it into a tree. And then he didn't try, as far as I know, seriously to be occupied as a landscape gardener. He got hired as a taxi dancer in a New York restaurant. This was during the dance craze, which seized the country around 1914-1915. And Valentino, who was not trained as a dancer, was just a very instinctively gifted dancer. And there were more women around who wanted partners than there were men who could partner them. So a new profession developed whereby women could go to these dance parlors, tea rooms they were sometimes called, and engage a male dancer to partner them, and in some cases to instruct them in the latest steps. And this was a profession that was frowned upon by the establishment. These men were called gigolos, a disparaging term, and it was assumed that they were up to no good, that they were going to seduce these women or just take their money. And the whole notion that a woman pays a man to escort her in any way was rife with controversy and scandal.
Why did he ultimately leave New York for California?
Well, before he left New York, he took a step up and became an exhibition dancer, which is much more respectable than being a taxi dancer. Exhibition dancers were very skilled and sought after, and in some cases very well paid. But Valentino became infatuated with a young married woman whose husband was a philanderer. And after he testified in the divorce hearing of this young woman, the husband, the philandering husband, exacted a revenge and arranged for Valentino to be set up and arrested. After that, Valentino fled New York and joined a traveling musical that brought him to California, which is a place he had always dreamed of. And he ended up in San Francisco. The show that he was in opened, but without him being in it. Nobody knows exactly why. So he went back to his old standby of being a dancer for hire, and he instructed women in dancing, and he also appeared in a couple of musicals in San Francisco before he ran into a friend he had known in New York who was making a name for himself in Hollywood, in silent movies. And that friend, Norman Carey, urged Valentino, who, by the way, was not called Valentino yet. His birth name was Rudolfo Guglielmi, and he urged Rudolfo to try his luck in Hollywood, which was burgeoning now during World War I, when the European centers of movie making were closing down.
What were his earliest film roles? I mean, what kinds of roles did he play?
Well, he was stereotyped as a villain because of his ethnic looks. For a leading man, it was required, people thought, that you had to look like the all-American boy. Leading men of the day, people like Douglas Fairbanks Sr. and Wallace Reid, were called arrow-collar men, which meant that they looked like the kind of square-jawed, dark-browed, wide-shouldered, all-American types that were familiar and in favor. And they weren't very sexy types. Fairbanks, who was a wonderful physical specimen and a very handsome man, didn't like to play love scenes, and he wasn't associated with love scenes. So the whole idea of Valentino being a leading man was something of a revolutionary. So initially, he was typed as a heavy, and he sometimes played comic roles, and he was very good at those. Unfortunately, he didn't have much of a chance to develop that part of his talent because of the sensation he eventually made as a romantic leading man.
When did he break out in Hollywood? What was his first big movie?
The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, which was released in 1921, was a sensation. And that was the movie in which he did the tango. Valentino's background as a dancer played a big part in his success on the screen, and many of his roles, including the Four Horsemen, featured footage of him actually dancing. He's dynamite as a dancer on screen.
His most famous role, at least for us today, was the Sheik, and the character in that role was really a sensation. I mean, why? What was it about that character?
Well, the Sheik, like the Four Horsemen, was a best-selling novel before it was a movie, and the Sheik and the Four Horsemen share one thing. In the leading man, from the point of view of an American audience, the leading man is an exotic. In the case of the Four Horsemen, he's an Argentinian gaucho, later a Frenchman, but he doesn't look like the boy next door. And in the case of the Sheik, he looks like an Arab chieftain and wears exotic robes and beaded headdresses and carries a curved sword and rides Arabian steeds across the desert. And he is a very forceful and ardent and passionate lover. This is something new in the American cinema, and the women just went mad. This is in post-World War I America, when women are feeling their oats in many areas. It's the time when they're campaigning for the vote. They're kicking up their heels and dancing. They're changing the way they dress. They're throwing away their corsets. They're wearing much more liberated fashions, shorter, without corsets. The body is not restrained. And sexuality is becoming much more available to women, and Valentino became the poster boy, quite literally, for the newly liberated woman in America.
And how did he play up the dark element, shall we say?
Well, one of the most famous scenes in American cinema is the abduction scene in The Sheik, where this handsome Arab chieftain, who it turns out at the end isn't really Arab after all, so that racial anxieties could be calmed, because of course interracial sex is a taboo in the movies at this time. But in the famous abduction scene, he seizes the beautiful English woman whose eye he has glimpsed before. He sees her riding on the desert without protectors or without European protectors, and he just captures her, kidnaps her by forcing her onto his horse with him and taking her into his tent. This is one of the most famous and sensational scenes in screen history. And women really did start having fantasies about being swept off their feet by a handsome chief who doesn't look like the boy next door and taken to a tent to be made love to. There was a lot of controversy about the amount of violence in the abduction scene. Believe it or not, critics claimed that Valentino wasn't harsh enough, wasn't rough enough in the abduction scene and the subsequent scenes that show him taking Lady Diana into the tent. In the novel by Ian Hull that had been a bestseller, the Sheik actually rapes the young woman. The movies didn't show a rape because of censorship fears, but critics criticized Valentino for his failure to rape Lady Diana, claiming that he was too soft and that he wasn't enough of a caveman. It's unbelievable to us in the 21st century that you would be criticized for failing to rape, but that's exactly what happened. What Valentino was able to do in The Sheik was to have it both ways. He does abduct Lady Diana. He does carry her off into his desert haven. But then he falls in love with her, and he becomes ardent, and he proposes marriage. So you have the savage, but you also have the man who will be tamed by a woman and become her devoted slave. And that was an irresistible combination to the movie-going female public, although the men didn't go for it.
It seems that as famous as Valentino's role in The Sheik is Valentino's death. How did Valentino die, and how did the public react to that?
Valentino died of complications from a perforated ulcer when he was only 31. And the public just went mad. The comparable moments might be the death of Princess Diana, the death of John Lennon, to a lesser extent, the death of James Dean. When a person who is very beautiful and very famous dies young, a transformation takes place, and they are lifted to the galaxy. The fact that you die young preserves you as forever young and turns you into a kind of romantic martyr. And the press played it up for all it was worth, and there were riots in New York. Valentino was in New York at the time that he died. And there was exploitation on the part of the funeral parlor, where the public was invited in for days as Valentino lay in state. Then there was a second funeral in California, and there was a funeral train that carried the body from east to west, and there were people who gathered at the side of the tracks everywhere to pay homage. So it was a huge media event, and it was startling and tragic to have this beautiful young man die so young.
We only have a moment remaining, but just one more question. Have there been any actors recently who evoke the spirit of Valentino, or was he that unique?
I don't think there's anybody since who had his combination of vulnerability, sensuality, foreignness. Marcello Mastroianni played some of the same kinds of roles, and he said that to be typed as a Latin lover is a dreadful limitation. It's like wearing Hancocks. And he was full of empathy for Valentino for having been typed in that way. Valentino was initially typed as a villain. He broke that mold, but then he got typed in another way as a Latin lover, and that was a limitation too. he wanted to be an actor who could play a variety of roles, but that didn't happen to him.
Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
We have been talking with Emily Leiter, author of Dark Lover, The Life and Death of Rudolph Valentino.
I'm a sheep I've ever been. Your love belongs to me. The night when you're asleep, into your tent I creep. Yeah, the stars that shine above will not outweigh to love. Your room is down with me. I'm a sheep, the sheep, the sheep of Arabia.
Following up on the interview you just heard with Emily Leiter, if you're a fan of Rudolph Valentino, you may want to take a look at the Rudy Fan website. Fiona Beatty joins us to tell you what you will find there.
Helen of Troy's was the face that launched a thousand ships, and Rudolph Valentino's the physique and charisma that made many thousands of hearts flutter. Valentino was a man who lived and loved his own myth. As he said, "I wanted fame, I wanted love, I wanted my name to ring around the world." And as my web search made clear, the fascination with the matinee idol continues. Of the many sites I discovered, I selected the Rudy Fan website. It is very comprehensive. You'll even get a tour of Falcon Lair, Valentino's Beverly Hills mansion, with photos of the house as it was prior to being sold in 1926, after Valentino's death, along with the auctioneer's description. There's plenty of reading material available on the site, including Valentino's autobiography. There are photographs of the smouldering, handsome actor, and that is not a reference to the ubiquitous cigarettes. A chronology and a comprehensive listing of his films. The site is well worth a visit, if only to experience the continuation of a myth. To find out more, go to www.geocities.com/Rudy Fan/Rudy.htm, and that's Rudy, R-U-D-Y.
About a boy, and I know it's stupid to be mad about a boy. I'm so ashamed of it, but must admit the sleepless nights I've had about a boy. On the silver screen, he melts my foolish heart in every single scene. Although I'm quite aware that here and there are traces of the cad about the boy.
For a commentary of the week, we switch from the fantasy life of the cinema to the reality of the Middle East and its ongoing conflict. Edwin Black is the author of a new book titled Banking on Baghdad, which chronicles 7,000 years of Iraqi history. He joins us today to share with us what he learned in his research for that book on the origins of the modern Middle East and the seeds of conflict therein.
America cannot succeed in Iraq until we understand the history we have ignored but recently repeated. For the past century, Iraq has offered only one attraction to the Western powers, oil. It has been a fatal attraction. During World War I, Britain invaded Mesopotamia, as those three neglected Turkish provinces were called, for oil and only for oil. Despite this, the British declared, "Our armies do not come into your cities and lands as conquerors, but as liberators." As part of that liberation, the British illegally seized the most valuable oil lands in Mesopotamia, namely the Kurdish Mosul region, a full week after the general armistice with Turkey. This illegal invasion enabled Britain to cobble together three ethnically separate provinces, and that is Turkish Mosul, Sunni Baghdad, and Shiite Basra. They made one single land that London would rename Iraq. The British then established Iraq as a nation for the sole purpose of structuring the exploitation of its oil. But Arab and Islamic nationalists in the newly invented Iraq did not want to share their land with infidel European Christians. Nor did they choose to share European values of democracy and pluralism, ideas that had never taken root in the Arab and Islamic Middle East for 7,000 years. It did not take long for the Iraqis to rise up in terror raids, burning, bombing, kidnapping, and massacring Westerners, including those sent to commercially develop and reconstruct the land and its waterways. The outraged British response to such horrors was aerial bombardment to shock and awe the villages. But the Iraqi violence and the British resolve to combat it with troops and tanks all persisted, and all for the oil wealth of Iraq. After World War I, the British and the French became ever more dependent upon oil. They engineered a secret petroleum pact sanctioned by the League of Nations, which divided up oil drilling and pipeline rights in Syria and Iraq. The oil pact was announced at San Remo, the same day the League of Nations granted mandates to Britain to rule oil-rich Iraq and France to rule Syria, where the pipelines would run to the Mediterranean. The British worked hard to instill democratic values in Iraq, thus creating a stable environment for the oil to flow. But it was a governance disaster because the people did not want it. Genocide against minorities, ethnic cleansing, repression, corruption, and neglect was the rule in Iraq for years. For eight more decades, the West, now with the United States joining France and Britain, has tried to hang on to its oil lifeline in the Middle East, using our best diplomats, corporate surrogates, and militaries. That has only fueled the cycle of insurrection and now world terrorism from a people who resent our presence and resource exploitation and have always understood better than anyone exactly why we are there. It is not sand we crave in Iraq. It is oil. America will never succeed in Iraq if we once again naively expect democracy to take root there and flourish. What possibly could occur next week or next month to transform that society that has not already occurred in the past 7,000 years? The only way to succeed in Iraq is to survive long enough to intelligently withdraw and then rapidly, at breakneck speed, develop alternative energy resources to detach us from this far-off place where we are not wanted, where we should not be, and upon which our industrialized world is now dependent.
You've been listening to Edwin Black, the author of Banking on Baghdad, published by Wiley Books. Black's commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Network. And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. As usual, we remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that our producer is Fiona Beatty, that our studio engineer is Alex Smith, and that the opinions offered by our guests on Talking History do not necessarily reflect those of the program staff or of the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. And finally, we invite you to send us your comments on this show by email, if you wish, to talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by regular mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.